Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Patino.
How are you?
And we are here today to talk with a very special guest, Jeff Marcy. Jeff is a professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley and a double major in physics and astronomy and probably one of the more distinguished guys I've ever met. Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
It's good to hear your voice, Walter. I'm doing fine.
Good. You know, I was thinking of reading this whole resume, but then I realized we wouldn't have time for any of the show. But it is impressive, and Jeff Patino here will go into just a little bit of it because we want people to know who you are.
Well, I know this number needs to be updated because as of January of 2006, which is over a year and a half ago, you and your team had discovered 110 extrasolar planets, which I'm sure is higher than that by now.
And up to 140.
Wow.
Nice to know you haven't just been sitting around, Jeff.
That's right.
And among the planets discovered are the first multiple planet system, the first Saturn mass planet, the first Neptune mass planet, and the first transiting planet. Their ongoing work is designed to study the mass distribution of planets and the eccentricity of their orbits. And the five-year goal is to find Jupiter analogs, which are planets similar to Jupiter at five astronomical units, which would be similar to our solar system. Dr. Marcy is participating in Berkeley's new Center for Integrative Planetary Science, which is designed to study the formation of and geophysics and chemistry and evolution of planets. And in addition to that, media-wise, Jeff has appeared on ABC's Nightline with Ted Koppel, CBS Nightly News, Nova, CNN, BBC, and David Letterman, among many other titles, and has been on the cover of Time magazine and was Discover Magazine's Space Scientist of the Year.
And there's about 1,000 more awards. You can go to the Jeff Marcy website and pull up a copy of the resume there. So anyway, Jeff, I hope we didn't embarrass you, but you have done more in this field than really anybody I've ever met. So my hat's off.
Honestly, we've been lucky. It's a lot of luck, a lot of hard work, and it's been fun.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, you always say we. Who are some of the other members of your team?
Well, my main collaborator for all these years was Paul Butler, who is now a staff astronomer at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. And can you still hear me?
Yes, we can. You can hear that. It just came in for some reason.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I don't know. What is that? Is there something we can do about that? No, it's gone away.
It's gone away.
What happens is NASA monitors all of my phone calls, and they, you know, you can sense it, and then the aliens start monitoring my phone calls, and so this is normal for me.
They're trying to figure out what you really do know.
That's right. I hope I'm kidding about that. So Paul Butler has been my ace collaborator for 20 years. I hear that again. I'll keep talking. I hope this goes away. Steve Vogt is a instrument builder, builds the spectrometers and the telescopes we use. Deborah Fisher is a professor of astronomy at San Francisco State University, and they all bring different types of expertise from optics to data analysis as well as planetary physics to the endeavor.
Well, it's an incredible team that you've had there, and you've been working together, 5 years or more?
Well, we started in 1987.
Oh, okay.
20,
I didn't realize
20 years
that.
Ago.
Wow.
And then when was the first exosolar planet discovered then?
Well, in 1995, a Swiss team and we discovered the first three planets. All happened within about 2 months. 51 Pegasi was found by the Swiss team, and we found a planet around 47 Ursa Majoris and another one around 70 Virginis. And those three, found in 95, were the first planets that we Homo sapiens had ever found.
And did you decide to look at these certain stars because they were close, or were there any telltale characteristics?
We are interested, of course, in planets around stars that resemble our sun. We'd love to know if our sun and its retinue of planets is unusual, whether our Earth is unusual, Jupiter is unusual, or whether, in fact, they are a common, dime a dozen sort of planets. So we, logically enough, began looking at, with our telescopes, the nearest sun-like stars. And so all three of those first three planets are orbiting stars very similar to close kin of our own sun.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Professor Jeff Marcy.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Jeff, we were just talking about the criteria of the type of star that you want to look at, and you gave a very logical answer that, you know, we'd like to know if planets exist around sun-like stars. So has all the focus been on sun-like stars?
Not at all. We've broadened our search for planets around other stars to include stars much smaller than our sun, some as small as a fifth the mass of our sun, and other stars that are 2 to 3 times the mass of our sun. And this is quite exciting because, of course, as much as we humans love our home star, the sun, we would also like to know whether planets exist and what their characteristics are around other types of stars. Who knows, maybe planets are quite different around other types of stars. Maybe some of them are more amenable to biology. And so it's quite exciting to ask the question, what types of stars have what types of planets? In our Milky Way galaxy, what is the full diversity of planets that we have within our galaxy?
And are you seeing any type of pattern there yet? Do sun-like stars tend to have planets more frequently, say, than giant blue stars or whatever?
We are seeing remarkable trends. And here's the answer. The smaller stars, stars a third the mass of our sun, let's say, have very few planets, and they are smaller planets. We almost never find Jupiter-sized or even Saturn-sized planets around the smallest stars. You might think that's quite logical, and I would too. In contrast, the more massive stars, those 2 to 3 times the mass of our sun, tend to have many more planets around them than we see around sun-like stars, and those planets are themselves more massive. So we're seeing what you might have guessed was logical. The biggest stars harbor the biggest planets and vice versa.
So it all kind of makes sense. And when was the first, star with more than one planet discovered? And was that you and your team that did that? Or?
Yeah, it was an amazing time. One of the stars we had been following for years, Upsilon Andromedae, visible to the naked eye, it's a fourth magnitude star in the constellation Andromeda. You can see it at night. We discovered early on a close-in planet that took only 4.6 days to go around the star, and we thought, oh, that's fine. And we watched it for the next year, and we were rather dismayed to realize that the star showed a sign of additional signals, as if there was something wrong with our original discovery. But in fact, what it was, not noise or errors, but in fact the signal of additional planets. And within about a year or so, by around 1999, we discovered 2 other planets orbiting that star, making a total of 3. It was the first family of planets, the first planetary system ever found around another star. And a little bit ironic that we would have guessed the first multi-planet system ever found would be a double planet system. You'd expect to find a star with 2 planets before you're lucky enough to find one with 3 planets. But in fact, this one has 3, and we've been following those 3 planets ever since. They're all 3 about the size of Jupiter, one of them about half the size of Jupiter. So it's quite exciting to see that, like our sun has a full family of planets, other stars do too.
Now, I know one of the things we mentioned earlier is that in your team's 5-year goal, it was to find Jupiter analogs at 5 AU. In any of the systems that you've looked at, have you found systems that would maybe correlate to our own that might have space for rocky planets to exist nearer
and,
to
and the follow-on the question, what is the longest periodicity?
Well, it's amazing you ask this question. I have something to announce that actually has not been publicly announced anywhere. We haven't even really published a formal paper yet. There is one of our stars, and I'll tell you its name. It's called HD 154345, and stars tend to have these HD phone numbers, I apologize for. And it has a planet that is about the mass of Jupiter. It's, I think, 0.98 Jupiter masses. In other words, 98% the mass of Jupiter, probably a little bit more than that, in fact. So it's very close to the mass of our Jupiter. Takes about 10 years to go around its host star. Our own Jupiter takes 11.8 years to go around the Sun. So this Jupiter has an orbital period, a time to go around once, almost the same, a little less than that of our own Jupiter. It's got the same mass as our Jupiter. The host star is very similar to our Sun. And here's the kicker. There are no planets that we've been able to detect inward of that Jupiter. Now, you might say, wait a minute, our own solar system, of course, has the Earth and Mars, Venus, Mercury, but in fact, our technology is not yet capable of detecting such small planets like the Earth. So this Jupiter around HD 154345 could well have a complement of small, undetectable, rocky planets, perhaps some at lukewarm temperatures with liquid water on their surfaces, and we would never know. So this is by far the best analog of our own Jupiter ever found.
Yeah, sounds like a near twin. And you said the technology isn't quite there to enable you to see smaller masses. And so what is the threshold in mass size? Or does it depend on...
Yeah, that's a very good question, and we're pushing hard on our technology to improve that. The smallest mass planet we've found so far has a mass about six times the mass of the Earth, six times bigger than the Earth. It orbits a star, by the way, called Gliese 876. And we're happy that we found a planet six times the mass of the Earth. What we want to do, of course, is try to go farther down the mass ladder, down to planets that are exactly the same mass as the Earth, and ask, are there such planets? How commonly do they occur? And are any of them lukewarm? So that's really for the future. Our one of our main goals for the upcoming few years is to find true analogs of our own Earth.
And does that then what require a telescope that has more light gathering capability, or what exactly do you need to make that happen?
Funny you should ask. We are currently building a new telescope at Lick Observatory in Northern California. This is a telescope newfangled. We designed it from scratch. It's all of our own. It has a mirror that's 2.4 meters in diameter, the same as the Hubble Space Telescope. And what its advantage will be is that we will observe nearby stars every single night, night after night after night, watching the stars to see if there's a close-in Earth-like planet. Close-in planets are easier for us to detect than farther-out planets. And we're quite sure, given our current level of technology, that we'll be able to detect Earth-like planets, planets of one Earth mass, three Earth masses, a few Earth masses, if they orbit relatively close to their host stars. I must interject that you could object yourself and say, well, wait a minute, our own Earth isn't that close to the Sun. Why should we care about close-in Earths around other stars? And the answer is that the stars we will observe are lower mass than our Sun and hence lower luminosity. And as dimmer stars, the close-in Earths that we hope to detect will be warmed up by the star to lukewarm temperatures. So the real excitement here is not just finding Earths, but finding Earths near enough to the campfire that the faces of the planets will be warmed up by the glow of the star to temperatures where the water...
Makes a whole lot of sense. And is it a fairly straightforward calculation? Let's say if Earth is an average 100 AU from the Sun, and you find a sun or a star that's half the mass of the sun, then do you, does something at 50 AU sort of give you the same potential? Or I guess it, there's a thousand other factors like atmosphere.
No, you're absolutely right. Just if I may correct you ever so slightly, I know what happened. Our Earth, by definition, is at 1 AU from the sun.
Oh, yeah, you're
right. And you multiplied by 100, that's fine. So we're really looking for planets like the Earth that would be at a half of an AU or a third of an AU, but around stars dimmer, so that they would be warmed up to the same temperature that the Earth is.
It's just amazing. You know, you start with like one little thread pulling on this information here, and you're... business is turning into a whole industry of information you can find out by looking so far away.
It's fast-paced, that's for sure.
Is it possible to tell the composition of the planets that you've found?
Amazing question, and remarkably the answer is yes, we are beginning to get a sense of it. And here's how, it's incredible. Some of our planets that we discover cross in front of the host star, blocking some, but not all, of the starlight. The amount of light that's blocked tells us how big the planet is in diameter. The bigger the planet, the more light is blocked. So we are now able to measure the diameters of the planets we're discovering, if we're lucky enough that they block the starlight. Knowing the mass of the planet from our technique, we then can combine the two to learn the density. Mass divided by volume, of course, is density. So we now have measured densities of a handful of our planets, and some of them have densities near that of liquid water and rock, as if they're composed primarily of rock and water. So it's an amazing advent that we are now at the stage where we can at least make educated guesses about how much rock, how much water, and even how much gas there is on these planets.
Hmm. That's fascinating.
Well, hopefully there's a lot of gas, and then our government will be inspired to go there quickly and try to harvest it and capture
it. You're thinking of natural gas. We're looking for oil on these planets.
I'm sure Exxon will find their way there someday.
It could be.
How do the size and composition of the planets, most of the ones you've found are like multiple Jupiter masses, is that correct?
Well, most of them are around the mass of Jupiter or Saturn, the biggest planets in our own solar system. We've found some 30 or so planets that are less massive than our own Saturn, so they would be the smaller planets, more or less like our Neptune in our solar system. And as you say, quite a few planets that have 5 or 10 times the mass of Jupiter. So we're seeing quite a range of diversity among the planets we've discovered that are somewhat representative of the, you know, the diversity we see here in our own solar system.
Makes a lot of sense.
So if I could backtrack a little bit, how did you first get interested in searching for extrasolar planets?
This isn't your average occupation.
It's a personal story, and it's a little embarrassing. I'll tell you what happened. I got my PhD in astrophysics at UC Santa Cruz, and when I graduated, I realized I didn't know what kind of research I would do next, and also began to feel that maybe my abilities were not very good. I noticed other scientists seemed to be quicker, smarter, more productive, and I started feeling kind of down about my chances as a real scientist. Maybe I didn't have the right stuff.
I can't believe that based on the number of papers you've written.
No, it's actually quite true. And I remember lingering in the shower one morning feeling quite distraught about my future. Maybe I would have to get out of science entirely. And with the water pouring down on me, I thought, well, if I'm going to fail, I'm going to go out in flames. Let me shoot to try to answer a question that has a human component, something that means something personally to me, not just a dry science question. And the flame-out question I thought of was, is our Earth unique? Is life in the universe a rarity or common? And I thought, well, I'm going to search for planets. At that time, we're talking literally the 1980s, 1983 or so, nobody had discovered any planets, and nobody thought it was possible to detect planets around other stars. The only information we had came from Gene Roddenberry and George Lucas. So it was a time when science fiction really provided all the information no science at all. And I thought, okay, I'm going to see if I can apply my skills, try to find other planets. And that set me in motion. And many people were embarrassed for me, thinking I was literally going to, make a fool of myself.
And you haven't quite succeeded yet, but we'll give you more time right after this break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. We're talking with Jeff Marcy. And Jeff, you just gave us the epiphany of your in-the-shower moment, and that set this whole thing off, and we're glad that you had that moment because it's led to a lot of fascinating questions. And I understand your latest discovery here is pushing the envelope even further. Can you tell us about the finding of how many planets around a star now?
Well, we're just now announcing this week the discovery of a star, 55 Cancri is its name. It's a G-type sun-like star that has five planets orbiting it. It's the record holder now. We had found one with four, and now finally 55 Cancri has five full planets. The fifth one is right in the habitable zone where the temperatures would be lukewarm, although I think it's a Neptune-like or Saturn even-like planet, probably too thick an atmosphere to support life, but who knows. So it's very exciting to see the first rich planetary system emerge that makes our own solar system with its eight planets seem rather ordinary.
Boy, it's starting to look that way. Now, what's the mass of this star, and what are the rough orbit periods?
So this is interesting. The star is nearly sun-like. It's about 93% of the mass of our sun. It's the same age as our sun, about 5 billion years old, same chemical composition, a little bit richer in the heavier elements than our sun, but otherwise a close analog of our sun. And what's fascinating is that the outermost planet of this system has four times the mass of Jupiter, and it orbits farther from the star, 55 Cancri, than our own Jupiter orbits the sun. It's at 6 AUs, unlike our Jupiter at 5. So this is a super Jupiter, you might say. And what's more interesting, in fact, is that the other four planets orbiting 55 Cancri are all inward of that giant Jupiter, just as our own solar system has its Jupiter and four small planets orbiting inward of it. So we're seeing, if you will, a sort of hyped up, you might even say planetary system on steroids version of our solar system.
But it sounds like just intuitively like a good model for harboring planets that have life. You keep a big one on the outside and to help protect the system, so to speak.
That's right. The big planets, of course, serve to gravitationally soak up the comets, the asteroids, the planetesimal debris from the planet-building era early on, cleansing the system so that if any life does spring up later on, whether microbial or advanced, such life will not be pummeled by impactors coming from the outside, blasting the planet's ecosystem and making life very difficult. So indeed, having that large Jupiter, four Jupiter masses out far, could be one of the key necessities of advanced life.
And if it's a sun-like mass, sun-like star, does that mean its age is very similar to our own solar system, roughly 4.5 billion years?
It is, and of course will last as long as our sun. Our sun is burning nuclear fuel, converting hydrogen to helium in its core, and so it is with 55 Cancri. Hydrogen is being converted to helium in the thermonuclear reactions in the center, and that will allow that star to live for about a full 10 billion years, just as is the case with our sun.
So we've got a little time left, at least.
No need to sell your stock quite yet.
How far is this star system from our system?
41 light years, spitting distance.
That's very close.
If you got a good spit.
Yeah, you better have one. And that's the real problem with this whole thing. I love the work you're doing, and you're, you know, I'm sure in it's going to be extremely valuable to when we have the ability to get out there and go to these places. But it's, I don't know, maybe it's a little kid in me. I'm just a little frustrated. We don't have the technology now, at least obviously, that allows us to get there.
Yeah, 41 light years, even as close as that seems on a cosmic scale, it's so far that if you wanted to borrow a cup of sugar, you better not need it for some 500,000 years, because with our current spacecraft speeds, it would take that long to go there and come back. On the other hand, as you were suggesting, our great-great-grandchildren, maybe 150, 200 years from now, will have developed propulsion systems that can send small miniature cameras built in Tokyo out to 55 Kankri, take pictures, send the images back. If the spacecraft can travel at, let's say, a half the speed of light, they can get there in 82 years. So it's possible that 200 years from now, it will be rather commonplace for a joint NASA-ESA Japanese mission to the stars, sending us back close-up images of the continents and oceans on those planets.
Yeah, and that's based on present-day paradigms. And, of course, if you have a big paradigm shift, for example, that we could actually figure out how to use a wormhole or something like that, then
exactly,
then all bets are off.
That's right. It could be even easier.
Yeah. Well, so it's...
How long of an observation period did it take for you to notice that there were five planets in this system?
Well, that's a really good question. We've been following this star with dedicated observations year after year after year since 1989, 18 years ago. And only with those 18 years of data could we tease out the signal of this fifth planet. And so it really is an effort of love and some enormous amount of patience to make this all happen.
Okay, and that's because the fifth planet, the Jupiter-sized one, takes close to a Jupiter-type period to get around this.
That's precisely right. It takes 14 years for this giant Jupiter to go around 55 Kankri. So we've now seen one full orbit and a little bit more of this most outermost of the five planets.
Okay, and we've just finished the orbit of our last segment. We'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. We're talking with Professor Jeff Marcy. And Jeff, the $64 billion question that everyone would like to know is there life out there? But before you answer that, I want to know where you're coming from. Do you personally have any strong feelings one way or the other about the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe?
Well, there's a lot of information now, and I think some of it is disinformation. We all grow up thinking, sure, there's got to be life out there. My goodness, there's so many billions of stars in our Milky Way galaxy, and there's so many billions of galaxies. Surely some of those suns have planets. Some of them are habitable. Life must spring up on them. And that is a very logical argument. I think it's correct. But the real question is, how close to us is the nearest advanced civilization? Are they 10 light years away or a million light years away? Do you have to go to the Andromeda galaxy clear outside our own to find the next civilization? And we don't know. So I don't even have a good answer. What's exciting is the enormous ignorance that we have. We don't have any sign of even microbial life on any other astronomical object, Moon, Mars, that you could say is definitively defendable, that everybody would agree, yes, that looks like life. And without that kind of strong commitment and consent about good, strong evidence, we have to throw up our hands in doubt and say, no evidence for sure of life in our solar system, maybe, but probably not. How about elsewhere? No strong evidence there that you would all bet your house on and say, yes, that's life. So we're quite ignorant. And I think the key question is going to reside in the hands of the people with radio telescopes who are searching with those radio telescopes, pointing indeed at our Earth-like planets that we're beginning to find with our planet search, hoping to find radio and television transmissions from any advanced civilizations if they're out there. It's an amazing prospect.
Yeah, or podcast transmissions.
That's right.
Now, is SETI, to your knowledge, are they specifically aiming their radio telescopes at some of the systems that
yeah.
you found that might indicate?
Have they changed it because of your work then?
Absolutely. We're working synergistically. We are, as you know, building this new telescope at Lick Observatory specifically to find Earths. We've been finding planets bigger than the Earth. And what we plan to do with the new telescope, if we can get a little bit more funding to finish it and operate it, find the Earths, alert our radio telescope friends at the SETI Institute, Dan Wertheimer, Jill Tarter, and others, and they, of course, will then point their newest radio telescopes. There's a new one, in fact, that Paul Allen, the founder of Microsoft, is building in Northern California called the Allen Telescope Array. And we've fully planned to point that new radio telescope right at the Earth-like planets and try to pick up any faint summer reruns from Alpha Centauri, if there are any.
You know, I guess what we've been using radio on this planet for 100 years, you know, give or take a little bit. So I wonder how long we will continue to use radio. Does our technology get to a point in 500 or 1,000 years that we, you know, discover more subtle waveforms or something? In other words, are we looking for something that a civilization only uses for a brief period of time in its evolution?
I think it's very likely that you're absolutely correct, and of course it's even worse than you've painted it. Already we see in our current technology, instead of transmitting our television programs over the air, we're using cable. And when we make telephone calls, we're sending a little signal from a cell phone to a nearby repeater that uses very few watts to send its signal to the next repeater. So already we are drastically limiting the electromagnetic power with which we send our own signals. And so it could be, as you say, that our transmitting technology represents a blink of an eye in the lifespan of a civilization so brief that we'll be lucky to catch another civilization in that same blink.
Especially in terms when you think about as advanced we think we are, we've really only been using radio technology for slightly more than 100 years.
And maybe only another 100 after this, and that'll be the end of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've got a positive note. I'm engaged right now, in fact, launching myself, a search for laser signals in the galaxy. Suppose an advanced civilization sends a spacecraft out to the stars, and then another one, and another one, and they colonize. Well, how will they communicate with each other over the vastness of space? They'll have to use electromagnetic waves, light waves, infrared, radio, ultraviolet, something. And we here on the Earth could pick up, eavesdrop, if you will, on their signals, perhaps transmitted by lasers. And so I'm launching a search right now that I've just started to pick up, if any, the transmissions in optical light and ultraviolet and infrared light from other civilizations. Is it a long shot? Yeah, it's an incredible long shot. But if we don't look, we'll never find them.
Let's see. I'm a little fuzzy on my knowledge of lasers, but it's a directed energy. You know, does one have to be fairly close to pick up that?
You're absolutely right, and that's part of what makes it a long shot. Our galaxy may have this intranet of lasers crisscrossing the galaxy like some sort of a security system in a museum, and we would have to be so lucky as to put our foot, so to speak, in one of those laser beams. But, of course, there could be a vastness of that internet such that much of space is crisscrossed by those laser beams, and if so, maybe we'll get lucky. If not, so be it. We'll have to keep looking.
That's interesting. I have read from time to time these listening stations do pick up a few anomalous signals that are difficult to explain, so maybe we are accidentally getting in the way sometimes.
It really would not be surprising if Star Trek and Star Wars were even remotely correct. The Romulans and the Klingons, or their analogs, are communicating with each other like mad, and we just have to happen to be in the beam.
Good. Well, it's good to hear that you're tuning into these shows, Jeff, because if you're leading the charge on finding this stuff, I want a guy who's been on the edge there. And we're getting close to the edge here of our upcoming break.
And yeah. In the meantime, as far as the five-planet system discovery, is there a website or something that people can go to learn more about that?
My team's website is exoplanets.org, exoplanets.org. And on Tuesday of this upcoming week, we will begin posting a lot of information, and NASA will have a lot of information. So there'll be plenty out there.
And that'll be today for our listeners. Okay, great. We'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
And welcome back to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host Walter Cruttenden, and today we are talking with Dr. Jeff Marcy. Jeff, welcome back for our last segment here. Before the break, we were talking about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life within our galaxy and even the universe. And you had mentioned something in a conversation before regarding the existence of advanced civilizations over the lifetime of the galaxy that I thought was really interesting.
Well, one question is, how many advanced civilizations, technological civilizations, are out there in our Milky Way galaxy, which, of course, contains 200 billion stars? What a wonderful Christmas tree we have in our galaxy of stars. But the question is, do advanced civilizations spring up? And if so, where are they? How many are there? And it could be that the reason we've had trouble finding them is that they are rare. And one reason they might be rare is that advanced civilizations spring up, they develop technology, and with that technology comes the ability to destroy themselves. So the lifetime of an advanced technological civilization may be measured in thousands of years rather than in millions or billions of years. And if so, the Christmas tree lights of a civilization may flicker on and then flicker off, and as you look at the galaxy over billions of years, only a few of the lights are on at any given time. And we may be, with humanity here, one of those few lights. And it may be that this is a message to us that we humans better take care of our planet, our environment, and frankly, take care of ourselves, work closely together to preserve ourselves as long as possible.
Well, that's always a good message to get. And, you know, I'm hopeful. It seems like we have the intelligence to solve our problems. We just, I think, need the willpower and the working together attitude to actually go out and do it.
We have enormous creativity as a species. We have a warmth. We care for each other. We care for our children. And we somehow just need a global perspective so that we care for the entire planet.
Yeah, I think it's dawning.
One last thing I'd like to touch on for our listeners is, could you explain the process of what exactly you observe in a star to see the planets around it?
Yeah, it's amazing. We actually don't see the planets at all, somewhat embarrassingly. We watch the star. And, of course, a star orbited by a planet will be yanked on gravitationally by its planets. So as a planet orbits a star, it pulls on the star, makes the star do a little circular Irish jig in space, and we simply watch the stars. Frankly, we measure the Doppler effect of that starlight and can tell if a star is wobbling toward us and then away from us, toward us and away from us, due to a planet or many, many planets yanking on that star. So it's really an indirect approach that allows us to detect all these planets.
Yeah, it's very logical. And then as you get a repeating signal, you know the periodicity of the orbit of that
exactly.
mass.
Exactly, and if anyone doesn't believe us, they can check by making their own measurements.
Okay. Hey, I'm all the time reading other things about space, and I read an article the other day, this may not be your area, but that was on this dark matter debate, and these couple of fellows, I forget where they were from, but they'd mentioned that they don't think dark matter exists.
Right.
And, you know, I was just at a conference at UCI there with Virginia Trimble, where we must have had 100 presenters all talking about dark matter, funded to work on finding dark matter.
Right.
Although none of them have found a smidgen of it yet. And so
right.
What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those ironies. If we had found it, it wouldn't be dark. But, you know, we're in a very embarrassing state, I think also a glorious state in astrophysics these days. Most of the material and energy in the universe, some 95% of it, is of a nature we don't know. There's dark matter and there's dark energy. And that makes up the bulk of our universe. We have no clue what either one of them is. We see their effects, but we don't know what they are. So we're more ignorant than knowledgeable.
Right. Well, I guess this whole idea of dark matter started off very logically that, you know, we understand how gravity works, and therefore there's just got to be things that we just can't quite see yet. And then, you know, as we develop the ability to see, we realized it's just not there.
Right.
And so the pendulum swung to look for WIMPs, and that's coming up dry. And so
right. No, it's a very challenging time for science. What I love about science is that we embrace and respect our ignorance. We don't try to shove it under the rug. It's also humbling to realize our ignorance. And so such is the challenge of that we Homo sapiens face, both the brain power to sense our ignorance and also the brain power to solve the problems.
Yeah, spoken as a true scientist.
Well, I'm omnipotent myself, so I'm kidding.
Okay, maybe down on the soul level you are. That's what we talk about sometimes. Anyway, Jeff, I really want to thank you for being on the show and spending so much time with us and giving your insights. Tell us, you know, what's the future? What are you looking for next? Where's your research go from here?
Well, we're delighted, of course, with this new telescope, if we can finish funding it, to look for Earths. And I you know, obviously, every school child would love to learn, as well as every older person would like to know, are there habitable planets out there? And it's a hope that in the next few years we'll be able to show you a picture, maybe with a space-borne telescope, of the first clone of our Earth, maybe with oceans, lakes, atmosphere, and habitability, to give us a sense that there are other abodes for life out there.
You know, and I'm not sure if I'm... Part of me says, oh, that'd be really neat. I'd love to embrace it. On the other side, too, you know, it'd be nice if we really took care of this one before we find out there's an alternate out there.
What is the furthest distance of a star that you've observed? Are they all very much in our local neighborhood?
That has a planet.
On a cosmic level, they're nearby. The farthest ones are about 300 or 400 light years away. But keep in mind that our Milky Way galaxy alone is 100,000 light years across. So essentially, we're living in a vast metropolis called the Milky Way, and we're only looking out our back porch for life.
Yeah, not even the back porch, just as far as the door jamb goes.
That's right.
But, I mean, that's good for us in terms of if we ever can see a high enough resolution to observe a planet, we know we're only looking at most maybe 400 years into the past.
That's right.
Okay. Well, Jeff, it's again been an absolute delight and pleasure having you on the show, and I hope we can get you back someday when you do find that Earth-like planet.
It would be my pleasure.
Yeah, would please pass our best on to your team, and thank you again for being on Cosmic Influence.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Well, we'll sign off with you then, and we're going to give websites.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
Thank you for listening to Cosmic Influence. Jeff Marcy has been just terrific to us, not only by giving us this interview today, but he appeared at one of our CPACs in prior years, and in our quest to understand the universe and how it works, you know, we run the gamut, going from hard science, like Jeff Marcy offers us, to some of the most far-out esoteric thoughts that are politically acceptable to think nowadays. And so we appreciate your tuning in, and we hope that you'll tune in again.
Until our next episode, bring on the higher ages.